Thank you, Andy.
Well, Dynamite hit Austin day before yesterday. He came in a day early. We didn't expect him until yesterday, and he came in day before yesterday and has had us on the go ever since. We are twice blessed because he came, and we are awed by the man's nature. He was born a long time ago up in the northeast of the United States. And somehow found his way over the years to the spotlight that brought him the world renown that we all know of Gordon McRae. Among so many things in his background are 23 motion pictures, the starring role, of course, in Oklahoma and Carousel, his television appearances, his nightclub appearances, symphony appearances. He's a man of many, many letters. A man of great success. An achiever who, in fact, achieved it all. I asked Gordon yesterday very seriously about his golf game because he does play and he plays regularly. I asked him, what is your handicap? And he very quickly said, whiskey.
Was
his handicap. And indirectly because of Mrs. Lyndon Johnson. And what happened is that a couple of years ago, Mrs. Johnson assisted this council and arranged for the appearance last year of Betty Ford. Yes, and arranged for the appearance of Gordon McRae. And it kind of came around in a circle. He is a guy you've got to be around to really know. He shares himself and he spreads himself wherever he goes. I noticed that at the state capitol yesterday as he walked through the rotunda because people were coming to him and he just brings them in. He has more warmth and more love than most any 10 people I've known. A man with great success and a man who has really gotten a hold of life. And he is our principal speaker today, and I'm just delighted to have Gordon McRae.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you very much. You took away a third of my speech, told where I came from and how I got here. Through wonderful Mary Love Bailey, actually, and it's just wonderful to be up here today. At least I hope it's wonderful. You know, Dan said I've made a lot of pictures, and I've been on a stage all my life. I've been working 41 years in this crazy business of ours, and I've only done this about maybe four times since I've been sober, and I get more nervous than being on a stage. I really do. I understand that 50% of you are non-alcoholic. I'd like to show you what happens at a meeting, for those of you who may not know, when a lady gets up and says, "Hi, I'm Gordon McRae, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic."
Hi, Gordon.
That's what we say in our meetings. So I see there's a few alcoholics here tonight, this afternoon. I'd like to pay tribute to people sitting over here on our left, you know, the people like yourselves who really put forth physically and financially to aid this wonderful cause is really indeed a great blessing. I'd like to say hello to my friend Dell Royal and his lovely wife Edith, who drove maybe 40 miles to come out and play golf yesterday with us. And when we saw the ice on the greens, we decided not to play. Thank you very much, Dell and Edith, for coming. I know you've been sitting here for a long time, and probably a lot of you have to go to the John. If you want to during my speech, go right ahead. I'll understand. But I'm Gordon McRae, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic, and I'd like to tell you my story. My story, for those of you in AA, is altogether different than yours. It's altogether different, you know. We don't have anything in common. Nothing I'm about to say ever happened to you, right, Dan? And I was born in East Orange, New Jersey, but my hometown is Syracuse, New York. I came from a wonderful, wonderful family. I'll be 60 years old March the 12th, so I was born in 1921, and I had a wonderful childhood. I had a kid sister and a lovely mother and father. I was brought up very religiously. I met a young lady over here who said, "I'm in CS, and CS stands for Christian Science." For those of you who are familiar with Christian Science, they don't believe in anything except the love of God. They don't believe in coffee. They don't believe in tea, really, if you live to the letter of the law, and especially booze and no smoking, things like that. But it's a wonderful, wonderful philosophy of life. So I was brought up in that atmosphere. My dad was a soloist in the church. My mother was what they call a first reader. And we even started a church in Syracuse, New York. It started a society and later became the Second Church of Christ Scientists. So that's the atmosphere that I was raised in. My family never had a divorce, and their family never any trouble. I think I remember my mom and dad fighting once, and very, very briefly. We were also very, very musical. My dad had a wonderful voice, and my mom played the piano. And I started out being musically inclined. My sister played the violin. And it was a happy, happy upbringing in Syracuse, New York. We were brought up in the Depression, but later on my father became a little lucky with a machine tool that he invented. And I've always been sorry that he never lived to see the results of that, because it brought a lot of happiness to a lot of people in the world. But he died at the tender age of 47 from a heart attack. And I lost my mother about 5 years later. But I was well, well brought up. And I always knew what I wanted to do in life. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't be sitting here today. I don't even know whether I'd be involved in alcoholism or not. I would have been a multimillionaire, because the machine my dad invented did help save the war. And the people we sold it to became innocently successful. But I'm glad that God gave me a talent, and it was God who did. And so I started, always was lucky at it. I worked hard at it, and I did have a good deal of talent, I think. Started out in 1940. I left Deerfield Academy, where my father had sent me. It's a very fine prep school in Massachusetts. And I started out the World's Fair. Won an amateur contest in the World's Fair. Strange enough, the prize was singing 2 weeks at a place called the Dancing Campus, which was then run by a fellow named Michael Todd. And little do we know that 14 years later, we'd be involved in a picture called Oklahoma. Well, I won the amateur contest, and then I got a job as a page boy at NBC, and that led to a fellow named Horace Height, whom a lot of you remember, giving me a job, and that led to... I was on the way up in show business. One afternoon, a fellow had laryngitis, and they heard me sing on his program when I substituted for him, and the moguls that were at the time at CBS and New York Radio signed me to a long-term contract, and I was heard on radio 580 stations a week, 5 nights a week, and on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I married her at an early age. I married a wonderful girl who I fell in love with, Sheila. I married her in May 1941. And, of course, Uncle Sam got involved in the war to end all wars. And I wanted to be a hero, so I volunteered for the United States Air Corps. And finally got in 1943. So my show business career was in limbo at that time, to the armed services, but I never got involved in booze. Never took many drinks. The young lady in the radio station here this afternoon asked me, well, what about when you were down here in Austin, and especially Texas? You know, they've been known to imbibe on occasion. I said, well, it never interested me, and I never did drink. After the war, I found out that I could do one of two things under the GI Bill of Rights. I could accept the monies that I had coming to me under my contract with CBS, or I could get paid for all the time I was in the service, or I could go back to work. Well, I elected to go to work, and I once went back on radio. A fellow producer heard me, and I ended up in a show in 1946 called Three to Make Ready with Ray Bolger, who was a wonderful guy and later became a very, very close friend. And then, of course, the ideal goal in those days was Hollywood, Lotus Land. And Lotus Land beckoned to me. I signed a long-term contract with Warner Brothers Pictures. I worked for Warner Brothers, made a lot of pictures, 23. You heard the figure that Dan gave you. Happy, happy musicals with Doris Day, who I introduced to her husband, who later turned out to be a thief. They were happy, happy days. And, of course, Dan mentioned Oklahoma, and I guess most of the people here, unless you're very, very young, know that I was lucky enough to play Curly in Oklahoma and Billy Bigelow in Carousel. About 1953, when I got Oklahoma and started to film it, I really started to drink. I didn't do much drinking then, but I guess what I always like to say is that I wasn't happy with just being a very fortunate fellow to have been selected to play Curly. And I was known as a big, big star then. I wasn't satisfied the way God made me, just as Gordon McRae. I tried to play God, I later figured out, through the help of the treatment center. And I started to drink. And I wanted to be the best well-known fellow at the bar at Lakeside Golf Club, which is the home of many and many a fellow who should be in our fellowship, and a lot who are. It was a wonderful drinking hole. But I wanted to be loved a little better than just being me, as I said, the way God made me. And instead of being grateful for my success, especially a year later when I was lucky enough to secure the role of Billy Bigelow in Carousel through, once again, strangely enough, the efforts of my friend Blue Eyes, Frank Sinatra, who decided he wasn't right for the picture, that I got the part of Billy Bigelow. Well, I started to drink a little socially at the Hollywood parties, you know, and it didn't bother me. I didn't get drunk. I was a happy, told a lot of stories. I was the life of the party, and when people like, say, Joan Crawford or some of them would get asked me or Dinah Shore or somebody who was there to get up and sing, I did it gladly and sober. Sheila and I were blessed with four children, one of whose birthday was yesterday. We had a wonderful family. I had three cars. I had Cadillacs. I had a Rolls Royce. I had a wonderful home. I had servants. We had a pool. To be what he was supposed to be. To raise his family. Well, my wife was what we call in our business, in our fellowship, an enabler. Sheila never really chided me about my drinking. Once in a while, she used to say, "Now watch it, don't drink too much." And she gave me permission to go out maybe once a week to play cards at the club, at Lakeside Golf Club, and once a week became twice a week, and sometimes three times a week. And the drinks progressed from beer to early times, and Jack Daniels, a wonderful drink, and later on, early times, and Jack Daniels with the beer, which is what they call a boiler maker, yeah. I love those. And I never really knew locks outside the place on the way to my car, and I drove into the lake one night, and I didn't think they knew I drank, and I'd make it home safely, except on October the 25th, 1955, toward the end of making the picture Carousel, we played cards one night at the country club till about 4 o'clock in the morning, and well, certainly. And about half an hour later, I woke up at the rear end of a three-car accident. My car was eyes and said hi, and it was the law. And I had, thank goodness, not going too fast, cracked up into three cars, stopped for a red light. Well, the law ended up there, and as luck would have it, I'll never forget the street. It's on the corner of Moore Park and Tahunga. And if you ever out in the valley and go by Moore Park and Tahunga, that's where I met. As luck would have it, a photographer for the Los Angeles Times lived in the apartment right in the corner. And it was a marvelous thing to wake up the next morning at home after getting out of jail. I was there for a couple of hours, his finger to his nose and attempting to blow up a balloon and walking a line on the highway. Marvelous thing for a wife and four wonderful children to see and the world to see. I went to court, and they fined you in those days $252 on a 502 charge, they call them in California. And the judge gave me about a 10-minute lecture. And I said to my attorney after that, I said, how come he didn't give a whole big lecture to people that were under the same charges? He said, well, you are who you are, and you're a little more important, I guess, to him. And I said, why did he pick on me? And I said, why did he do that? He said, well, as I told you. And he said, also, he said, I think you're kind of lucky that you didn't hurt anybody, because that judge, I'll never forget his name was Judge Julian. Judge Julian's daughter was killed 6 months previously by a drunken driver. Well, that sort of hit me right where it hurts for a while, and I went on the wagon. Long about this time, I got interested in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was privileged to sing for the annual, the five-year party they have up in Toronto, Canada, and I met the fellow who founded AA, Bill W., and his lovely wife, and I met a lot of wonderful people, and actually, during some of those years, I brought dreaming that a few years hence that I would become progressed. I was a practicing alcoholic. It never affected my work. I was never self formed a pretty good, successful partnership that maybe some of you in the room used to visit, see. We were down here in Texas and Houston and then Dallas, and we played everywhere. And we were highly successful. We broke records wherever we went. But gradually, off hours, I was becoming a real practicing alcoholic. I'd fall asleep when getting home. My family, who I loved very much, I didn't see very much. On the road, I'd go to the club and do my drinking there. And I was careful after the one incident that I got drunk to have someone drive me home or call a taxi. But it was getting to me. And one day, Sheila came to me and said, I think it's over. Of course, there's many other things that enter into the leading factor to the demise of my first marriage, which lasted 26 years. And one day, I was playing a hotel down in New Orleans, the Roosevelt, which later became the Fairmont Hotel. I got a long-distance call from Sheila. She was in Juarez, Mexico. And I said, well, hi, darling, how are you? She said, well, I'm fine. She said, I'd like you to know you're free. I said, free from what? She said, free of me. She said, I just divorced you. And I said, why? And she gave it a beat and said, why? She said, well, that I was a very good father, and I was, until my drinking got too severe. That was the demise of my first marriage. I used to go on the wagon a lot. I never really got interested in Alcoholics Anonymous, as far as being willing to say that I was an alcoholic. I started my second marriage 14 years ago. Married a fine, fine lady from New York. We were blessed with another daughter, little Amanda, who is now going on 13 years of age. And my present wife hated California. She's not too happy about the earthquake. But she sacrificed her fear of earthquakes to accompany me to back to Lotus Land. I'd left there and moved to New York and done a couple of plays on Broadway and was still going around the country doing very well at my craft. She came out and Mandy started to grow, and my drinking was just sort of stable. I could drink or not. Then when Mandy became of school age she's 13 now, I guess about 6 years ago, when she was five or six, I got to drive her in the mornings to school, a wonderful school called Beverly Vista, which is about a minute and a half or 2 minutes from my home in Beverly Hills. And I enjoyed doing that. My wife used to say, gee, he's a wonderful husband. He had to come back on the road and get up in the morning at 7:45 in the morning and get up and allow me to sleep and not drive Amanda to school. But what she didn't know was that after I dropped Amanda at school at 8 o'clock or maybe 1 minute after 8, that there was a wonderful bar 2.5 blocks away called Ye Little Club on the corner of Little Santa Monica and Cannon Drive. And what she didn't know was that I found out that the bartender, who is a marvelous gentleman, got off the bus at 8:15 and opened up the bar maybe at 8:16. So I enjoyed dropping Amanda off at school because the bar opened at 8:16. And I used to go in there and I'd say, good morning. Well, you can imagine what wonderful company I had at 8:16 in the morning at a bar in Beverly Hills. Wonderful, high-class people, I want to tell you that. Well, I'd start to consume, and would consume maybe in a half an hour, about 4, 5, or 6 screwdrivers. And then I'd leave there, and I'd go down to the store and buy a pint of vodka and the local trade papers and the local papers. And I'd go back to my home, and I'd stick the bottle underneath my favorite chair in my den, and read the paper and be perfectly, perfectly happy. And my wife used to say, it's wonderful to have you home and sober. And I go, ha, 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 ha. Ah, the games we played. Well, it got worse and worse. And finally, a lot of other things happened, but I'll bring you up to 2 years ago, to about the month of July, actually. And my wife used to admonish me about my drinking. I said, don't worry about it, don't worry about it. And I used to go on the wagon very successfully. But July of 78, I'd been on the wagon for Oh, about 4 months. And I had to come down to Texas, strange enough, to Dallas and sing at a young lady's wedding that I promised her father I'd do about 21 years ago. And I kept my promise, and I was on the wagon. And the fella said, well, you got to have a little wine to toast the bride. And I said, no, I better not, knowing full well how alcohol worked. But I did. Well, I went on another two for about 3 months. And, no, that was early in the year. That was about in May. And then in July, they had a wonderful tournament that I got involved in called the Greater Greensboro Open, which involved a lot of celebrities. I was again on the wagon, and I got a lot of my fellow golfers together, a lot of whom Darrell knew, and put them all together and brought them down to Greensboro. And I was on the wagon. They had a marvelous, jolly time on the airplane. They were all drinking and playing gin rummy, and I was sober as a judge. And I got them all down to Greensboro. And then we were waiting to go out to dinner one evening, and the bartender in the hospitality suite said, I notice you don't drink, Mr. McCray. I said, no, I don't drink. I said, I'm on the wagon. He said, well, there's a nice little drink that won't hurt you. He says, Kahlua. I said, why don't you try that? Well, I thought to myself, geez, well, it's got sugar in it, it's sweet and everything. So I took a Kahlua. And that was Tuesday night, and they always have the pro-am tournaments the Wednesday before the regular pro tournament. Well, I got on that first tee. I missed the ball. I won't go into it. It was just an utter disgrace. In front of maybe 2,000 people in the gallery, and all of whom knew that I was there and who I was, and that I'd helped to get all my buddies together. My buddies were looking at me. I missed the plane going home. I did a sloppy job trying to MC the show that night. It was just a disaster. And that was the beginning of it. And then in October, I had to sing three concerts right in a row. I did one in Detroit on a Tuesday night. I did one in Cincinnati, Ohio, the next night. And on Thursday, I was supposed to do one in Greenville, South Carolina. And to show you how this disease progresses, you just lose your tolerance. On Monday night, I received a standing ovation. Having a couple of drinks, just normal drinks, I used to drink vodka with 7-Up. And on Tuesday night, I sang in Cincinnati to standing ovations. But the booze, it didn't bother me. It was a different situation, however, on Wednesday night, the 26th of October, when we flew to Greensboro, South Carolina, to do a concert in front of 3,000 people. And the young lady on the plane gave me a little of those cute little shots of vodka to drink, to warm up with when I wasn't flying on the plane. Well, I attempted the concert, and I'll always keep this with me. This is what was in the paper the next morning. The headlines say, Singer McCray let off stage. Singer-actor Gordon McCray was let off stage about 20 minutes into the Greenville Community Concert Series opening performance Thursday night. Though McCray kept his poise during the short performance, the veteran of 30 years in show business repeatedly forgot lyrics and sang out of tune. What's next? He called 3 or 4 times to his accompanist. McCray was administered oxygen backstage and was driven to his motel. Attempts by the Piedmont today to locate McCray or any member of his entourage were in vain. McCray and his manager reportedly flew out of Greenville to New York early today. And here's some of the quotes in front of 3,000 people. I did this. It's a shame when a man brings 3,000 people out solely to hear him, not a piano or other groups, and he pulls a trick like that. We hope to come up with a concert in the spring, Mrs. Green said. McCray will not be booked again, she said. I came all the way from Ware Shoals, and now I've got to wait for a ride home, said one. I think it's embarrassing to the people who worked so hard to get memberships, but this is the last time I'm coming to one of these, said another. So that's what happened to Gordon McCray, the All-American star of Oklahoma and Carousel, on October the 25th. I was supposed to cruise off on the Rotterdam for a week's tour of Nassau and Bermuda. Earlier that year, in June, we had sold out the Rotterdam with a lovely young lady whom you all know named Helen O'Connell. And I wasn't drinking, I wasn't drunk on that cruise. We had the biggest crowd that they've ever had on the Rotterdam. So that was, flew back to New York City on Friday after the disaster in Greenville. Felt pretty good, a little hungover, a little shaky. I went down to my tailor at 10 o'clock in the morning to pick up a brand new tuxedo. And this is to show what alcohol does to you. All of a sudden, you lose your tolerance, and you are a drunk. I picked up my suit, and I usually stay at the New York Athletic Club, which is kind of nice. All the sort of stories for sort of staying in shape, always try to do. And a few of my buddies wanted to wish me bon voyage starting around noon. So I had a few drinks, and then I got sick, and I got flushed, and my heart started to beat. To make a long story long, I left another 1,300 people alone on the Rotterdam without the services of Gordon McRae. I left my conductor on a street in front of a hotel waiting for a cab. I never showed up. Well, I called home and I told my wife, I said, I'm coming home. And she said, no, you're not. On one condition, that you put yourself in a treatment center. Well, they have a wonderful treatment center in Lincoln, Nebraska. And I said, what? Go to Lincoln, Nebraska, that my new adopted town where there's only maybe 160,000 people who all know me and put myself and declare myself an alcoholic. She said, I don't care where you go, but you go to a treatment center. And I did. That was October the 31st. I celebrate my birthday because it's easier for a silly actor and a singer to remember the 1st rather than the 31st. And I called a wonderful fellow who became my sponsor. His name is Doogie Doyle. And Doogie said, well, I was wondering when you were going to call me. The door has been open for you for a long time. I wondered when you were going to walk through. And that was the best day of my life, to call Mr. Doyle and to be admitted into the treatment center called the Independence Center in the beautiful little town of Lincoln, Nebraska. And to finally admit that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. And that was the big, big thing. And that's the trouble with the disease today. That's a hard word to say, that you're an alcoholic. But it really, really shouldn't be. In the treatment center, you go through, I don't know if a lot of you have probably been through treatment, but there we had to be accepted by your peers, a group of people sitting around a table that size, maybe 8, maybe 10. And you had to get by the first 5 steps. And a fellow told me, I said, well, how about this first step? He said, well, you just admit that you're powerless over alcohol, and they will accept it. Well, I sat there for 3.5 weeks. And when you're ready to tell your story, like I'm telling now, your peers say they'll accept your first step, and then you can go on. Well, for 3.5 weeks, they wouldn't accept my step. And I didn't know what was happening. I said, I'm telling my story. You need to go back and try again. They turned it down 3 times. And finally, I went to a girl there who was an assistant to the counselor. And I said, something's wrong. What am I doing wrong? She said, well, you're going away to sing this weekend. Instead of thinking about a book, which is sort of a little Bible that we have in AA, stop thinking about all the things you've learned and meditate. And I did. And I came back to the meeting Monday. And in the meetings, I don't know, in the group, in the sessions, you have to raise your hand real fast. And boy, I had my hand raised when I was walking through the door. And I said to a fellow named Darrell. Darrell was a pimply-faced kid with one of his teeth missing, and he had holes in his shoes. And I said to Darrell, I said, I want to apologize to you, Darrell. By the way, Darrell's first step was accepted the first time that he gave. And he said, what for? I said, because I thought that I was better than you. I thought that my name is Gordon McRae, that I have money, I have fame, I have a family, I have clothes. I said, but Darrell, I am no better than you. I am just a plain drunk. And I apologize to you for thinking that I was better than you, and I apologize to the whole group. In other words, through the help of God, I had finally gained a little humility. And it was a revelation. And from then on, it was easier, knowing that you were just another drunk. And there's a lot of us sitting here today. Started my journey in this wonderful... While I was going through the treatment center, I was a day patient because I had commitments all over the country. And while I was still in treatment, I was actually out into the world and going to AA meetings. And I went back to the treatment center later. I said, boy, if they could do that more often with the people, the boys and the girls and ladies and gentlemen who are in here, it would be a wonderful thing. So while I was going through treatment, I came out and experienced
Alcoholics Anonymous and how it really works. And it was just marvelous. I started my journey. There's a fellow who is, I guess, akin to Cecil, one of the real old AA members. And he wasn't too enamored of the treatment centers. He used to say, a treatment center is just a cab ride to the airport of Alcoholics Anonymous. And maybe he was right, but it was a wonderful cab drive. And what happened to me? I figure that with the way I was brought up, I put God, as I understood him, in limbo for, I figured, 23 years. I went to church, I never listened, but alcohol was my God, and my ego was my God. And what did AA do? It brought back God, my higher power, as the minister said, back to me after many, many years of being in limbo. And I didn't become an all-fired up religious fellow. Sometimes I still don't understand him. To me, God, if you've ever been privileged to attend an AA meeting, that's where he is. God is a lot of you people sitting out there to me. To walk into an AA meeting, and maybe sometimes you don't even feel like going to a meeting. You physically don't feel like, say, oh no, I'll go tomorrow. And you walk in there, and you see the faces, you see the joy, you see happiness amongst your fellow men, and it's just a truly amazing thing to me. It's a miracle. And I don't know, I still can't explain it. I've been all over the world, and to share with people. It's a sharing, and it's a caring, and it's a needed thing, and it's a very, very simple program. Dan mentioned in one of the awards, tough love. You get an honest opinion of yourself from other people, your drunken buddies, be they male or female. And it's just an indescribable something. It's love. And that was brought back to me. I was brought up with the principle that love is reflected in love. And through Alcoholics Anonymous and my attendance at the meetings, which to me is very, very vital. I go to meetings all over the world and five times a week when I'm home in Lincoln, Nebraska, just to share and to see what's going on. And now that I'm sober, my life has changed. My attitude has changed. I feel wonderful, and I'm able, in my profession, to stand on the stage wherever I am and sing, which is what I do the best, and give love and get it back. And it's just, to me, a miracle. Of course, I didn't have any choice, really. The day I went to the treatment center, the day before, my blood pressure was 280 over 165. My liver was fat, my heart was beating, and I was a walking stroke. Really, I didn't have any choice, and neither did any of the other people who are involved in, or were involved in drinking, had a choice. There's two choices, slim and none, they say. You either want to live, or you want to die. And if you keep drinking, you're going to die. Well, I wasn't ready to die right at that present time. And I don't know, I could go on and on and on about what I've done down here. I made a speech in Beverly Hills a week ago Monday. I'm going down to Houston. And it's an amazing thing. And what is great about it, looking at the kids over there, I don't know whether they're involved in alcoholism or have any alcoholics in their family. if anybody were to look at those young faces and know that we can help blowing up a balloon on the street in Austin or San Antonio or Beverly Hills. And it's just, I keep reiterating, it's just, it's amazing. Our program is very, very simple. As long as you're willing, as long as you admit that you are powerless over alcohol and that your life had become unmanageable. I had a time last year, we mentioned our 12 steps, which is the ultimate in our program. If we can give help to another alcoholic, I was privileged to organize a seminar to make the clergy aware of our problem. And they are, in Los Angeles, It wasn't easy, and that's where I got Betty Ford to come, and that's why I sort of repaid her the favor she did to me. And also, I'm wearing a tie here today which has a Scotch tam on it with a pom-pom, and that's symbolic of a golf tournament that they asked me to host. We had the first Gordon McRae Celebrity Golf Classic last October, and God willing, it'll be for the rest of my life. And I was privileged to invite Betty Ford and President Ford and my friend Bob Hope to come out and participate in this tournament, and they did. And what a wonderful thing it is, when you think about it, to have a former president of the United States and his lovely wife and a person is like Bob Hope to come out and help out me to tell the world that alcoholism is a disease, a treatable disease, and is not a stigma. That alcoholics are real, wonderful people. And I was very, very grateful to them. But I owe it all to, as I said, my God, my higher power, and I pray every day that it will continue one day at a time for the rest of my life. A lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous really don't believe in God. A lot of people do. As I said, I get it from going to the meetings every chance I get. I did, however, read a thing in the Newsweek magazine about 2 years ago on the Albert Einstein's birthday. And, of course, it told all about the things that he dealt in and about the formulas that he devised. And then later on, it asked him a few simple questions. And here's a man and a group of men that he dealt with that dealt in physical things and atom bombs and things like that. And he was asked what he thought about a scientist's and prayer. In a quote from him, it says, "Everyone who is seriously involved in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that a spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit vastly superior to that of man, and one in the face of which we, with our modest powers, must feel humble." To me, that means a great deal. We begin our meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous, for those of you who are not familiar with it, with a chapter out of the big book. And the last sentence in one of the things we read is always in my heart. In chapter 5, it's called How It Works. And it says that it brings to mind three pertinent ideas. I always think they ought to change that ideas to facts, because to me they are facts. It says that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, here's the one that hits me, that God could and would if he were sought. That's how it's worked for me for 27 months now. I pray to God every day that I'll be up here many, many times over until I go to my greater place. And there's a thing we say in AA, how wonderful it is to get up every morning instead of good God morning, to get up and say, "Good morning, God. I thank you very much."